Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
On manque d'ouvriers spécialisés dans le monde entier. Le métavers peut contribuer à résoudre ce problème. La plateforme de formation en réalité virtuelle de ForgeFX permet aux futurs soudeurs de s'entraîner encore et encore. Ils apprennent ainsi les compétences nécessaires pour débuter et faire évoluer leur carrière. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
I'm Lise Doucette with the Global Story Podcast. Today, we have rare access to Sudan, a country, entire communities, millions of lives torn apart by a devastating war. A war which many Sudanese believe the world has forgotten or is just ignoring. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from our BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday the 19th of March, these are our main stories. Hong Kong passes sweeping new security legislation. The US urges Israel to allow more aid into Gaza. And we visit San Francisco, which is seeing record numbers of deaths from fentanyl drug overdoses. Also in this podcast, the memorable moments in Prince Andrew's 2019 BBC interview turn into a film with Gillian Anderson playing the interviewer Emily Maitlis.
The different moments where it almost didn't happen, so why not dramatise up until one of the most important and dramatic interviews in history?
And
you have to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Possibly the most famous pair of ruby slippers in the world, going on tour ahead of being sold at auction. Let's start in Hong Kong, where a new national security bill has been passed. Many fear it'll restrict freedom and fuel a culture of fear in the city, which is ruled by China. The package, known as Article 23, targets new offences like external interference and insurrection. Hong Kong's leader, John Lee, hailed its passing as a historic moment for the people and said it would be good for stability. So how did this new law come to be passed? I asked our Asia Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
Well, Andrew, it's important to note that this is the law that was just passed by the legislature. It's actually a law to replace one that was already imposed by Beijing back in 2020. That existing law was already pretty tough. 300 people have been arrested under it. It's led to the shutting down of civil society groups disbanding, newspapers disbanding, and dozens of opposition politicians and activists going abroad or heading to prison. Now, this new law, Beijing basically ordered Hong Kong, the authorities in Hong Kong, to come up with their own law to replace the one that Beijing had imposed. The new law that Hong Kong lawmakers have been working round the clock to pass adds new crimes, as you said, foreign interference, insurrection. They've also added new punishments, up to life in prison. Unfortunately, though, critics say these laws are quite vague, and so it's easy to be prosecuted because it's really unclear where the red lines are.
Lots of reaction to the principle of the thing. What will it actually change in terms of people's lives in Hong Kong?
It's thought to change things in two ways. On an individual level, people who work in certain professions are really worried because, as I said, the laws are quite vague, and so they're not clear whether they'll be crossing those lines at any time. Lawyers, journalists, government workers are worried, even priests. You know, it was said during the passing of these laws that if a priest is listening to a confession and someone tells them something that could lead to insurrection or something that they think is actually a criticism of the Chinese Communist Party or the Hong Kong authorities, those priests could actually be breaking the law if they don't alert the authorities of what they heard in a confession. And on a bigger level, Hong Kong's status as an international city is really affected here, because things like working with external forces is now considered to be a crime. And so that's really led many people to say that this will just radically change Hong Kong and make it just like any other mainland Chinese city.
Senior Hatton reporting. Next to the war in Gaza, and Israeli negotiators have been in Qatar for a new round of ceasefire talks. Qatar's foreign ministry spokesperson says Israel's top spy chief has left Doha, but the talks are continuing. Meanwhile, there have been more US diplomatic moves to try to ease the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. In a phone call with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, President Biden said Israeli plans to continue a military push into the southern city of Rafah, where over a million people have sought refuge, would be a mistake. Speaking at a news conference, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the entire population of Gaza has acute food insecurity and stressed that facilitating humanitarian assistance was a priority for the US.
We've seen positive actions in the last couple of weeks, including the opening of a new access point that's allowing aid to go both north and south. But we need more. We need it to be sustained, and we need it to be a priority if we're going to effectively address the needs of people.
Anna Foster is in Jerusalem for us. I asked Anna if there's any chance of a breakthrough in this latest round of ceasefire talks.
Well, these talks have been ebbing and flowing for months now. You remember it was the end of November last year was the last time we had any kind of ceasefire deal. It only lasted for 1 week. And since then, there have been occasions where the parties have been, I say, around the table. Of course, remember, Israel and Hamas are never around the same table. They don't have direct diplomatic relations. So everything is mediated through Qatar and Egypt. But there have been times when we've been told that they are talking. You might remember there was hope that some kind of deal could be reached before the beginning of Ramadan. I mean, we're more than a week into Ramadan now, and you might remember those images that we saw of the US President Joe Biden licking an ice cream, saying he was confident that that would be the case, but of course it never came to pass. Now, the fact that the two sides are talking again is a positive thing. One thing we are told is that nothing is likely to happen quickly. They're saying minimum 2 weeks to try and thrash out any kind of deal. There are still elements that the two sides don't agree on, particularly things like Palestinians being able to return to their homes in the northern parts of Gaza. There are discussions still going on about how many hostages would be released in any deal, who they would be, how many Palestinian prisoners would be released in exchange. So there are still points of difference that exist, but the suggestion is that both sides are trying to work towards at least resolving those.
I mean, looking at what's happening on the ground or what's being said, there wouldn't appear to be much cause for optimism at the moment. Is that fair?
Well, it's fair to say that when you look at what's going on the ground, you're right. I mean, the situation is terrible. The humanitarian situation for civilians in Gaza is absolutely dire. At the same time as talking about a ceasefire deal, Israel is repeatedly saying that it intends to carry out a ground offensive in Rafah, where more than half of the population are displaced. Of course, you still have more than 100 hostages who are being held in Gaza, and desperate families. I was talking to one of them just yesterday. Desperate families who want to see their loved ones released and want the Israeli government and others to do more to make that happen. So it seems, you're right, extraordinary that there's so much pressure, both internationally from all directions, internally as well, and that nothing seems to be moving with any kind of pace.
Anna Foster in Jerusalem. The head of the European Council, Charles Michel, has said EU countries must significantly invest in defence to be on a war footing. In an opinion piece printed in publications across the continent, Mr. Michel said Russia's invasion of Ukraine posed the greatest security challenge since the Second World War. This from our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
Charles Michel's warning is stark. If Europe does not give Ukraine enough support to stop Russia, he argues, the EU will be its next target. Moscow, he said, was continuing to try to destabilise Moldova, the Western Balkans, the South Caucasus and parts of Africa. Mr. Michel accused the Kremlin of spreading blatant lies to try to convince Europeans that the war in Ukraine didn't concern them. The EU, he stressed, had to take responsibility for its own security and not remain at the mercy of election cycles in the US, a reference to doubts in Europe over Donald Trump.
Next to Venezuela, a country that's endured political and economic crises for almost a decade. In July, voters there will go to the polls. On the ballot paper for sure, President Nicolas Maduro, who was re-elected for a second term in 2018 in a vote which was widely dismissed as neither free nor fair. But the opposition leader has been banned from taking part due to alleged financial misconduct, which she denies. Washington has threatened to reinstate economic sanctions if she's barred from running, but time's running out because candidates have to be registered by next Monday. And Maria Corina Machado has been talking to the BBC World Service.
They will not take us out of the electoral path. We are going and we're fighting for free elections, and Maduro is the one who's boycotting them. And we want to transit a peaceful route while Maduro is provoking violence. And we are proposing a serious negotiation for a transition with guarantees, and Maduro is refusing it.
If you aren't allowed to run, do you think the United States should reinstate sanctions on Venezuela's economy?
Well, that was part of the agreement the regime signed with the United States, in which both parts committed to different actions. The United States has fulfilled its agreement and what they announced they would do. The regime has not. On the contrary, they have violated every single term of the Barbados Agreement, and they had increased dramatically repression and persecution. Even as we speak, there are four managers of my campaign in four different states of Venezuela that disappeared by the regime forces and now are being held prisoners in a prison called El Helicoide, which is the biggest torture center in Latin America. They don't let me travel around the country by plane. They block the routes. They attack us. And I believe the world should hold accountable Maduro, because the consequences of Maduro staying by force would be huge, not only for the region, because the region should prepare for the biggest migration wave we've seen so far. I'm talking about millions of Venezuelans who will flee if they lose the hope of freedom and prosperity in their homeland. But also, I have to insist in how the very dangerous liaisons Maduro has with Russia and Iran are being intensifying, and that would that mean for the Western democracies if Maduro stays by force? So this is a critical moment, very delicate hours, and what we do, both Venezuelans and the international democratic community, in the hours to come, I believe will be critical for decades.
The Venezuelan opposition politician Maria Corina Machado talking to my colleague Rob Young. Fentanyl can be up to 50 times stronger than heroin, and it's extremely easy to overdose on. Last year in the US, more than 100,000 people died of an overdose, with the majority being from synthetic opioids like fentanyl. Our correspondent in San Francisco, James Clayton, has been speaking to one former addict.
I'm with Brian, a man in his mid-30s who looks remarkably well, considering his history of substance abuse. He was homeless and on the streets of San Francisco for 3 years, between 2020 and 2023.
Mama, you want a cigarette?
We're out in his old stomping ground by a street corner. A woman is holding a metal baseball bat. A man begins to light foil with his lighter.
There's someone actually doing fentanyl right there.
Oh yeah, that's... you're going to see that. Like, people don't give a...
Brian says his addiction slowly got worse. Pills, then heroin, then fentanyl. After spending time in prison for a drug charge, he moved to San Francisco and began to sleep on the streets. We walk by a man slumped over in the middle of the street, seemingly passed out.
And I always wondered, like, why don't you go and get undercover or something? And it's because you're just exhausted. You're, like, just sheer exhaustion, and you lay where you fall, you know? So, yeah, I've been there. Been there plenty of times.
It's an all-encompassing desire. Like, it's a 24-hour-a-day job. All you're doing is acquiring money to make sure you still have dope. Because even when you run out, like, obviously withdrawals are looming. Like, they're gonna come in a matter of hours. I was a booster. So what I would do is I would go to a store and I would steal shit.
To keep up his habits, Brian regularly stole items from stores and sold them on the streets for his next fix, which he knew could be his last.
There was one time we were sitting on a ledge smoking dope, like me and a few guys near the drug dealer spot. And there was a guy like laying down on the ground, kind of watching him, but he wasn't moving, but people laying on the ground, sleeping all over the place in that area, you know? And then somebody went over to him and he was dead. By the federal building, like on the sidewalk of the federal building, there was a dead body sitting for hours. And that's just regular Tuesday morning or whatever.
In 2022, Brian's feet were starting to get more and more swollen, a common problem for fentanyl users. He walked with a limp.
I had cellulitis, like, which is a cellular infection in my legs due to like poor circulation.
Brian did survive, though, and says the experience changed him. He's been clean for nearly a year now.
You definitely regain or even grow a greater appreciation for little, like, small pleasures. Like the sound of skateboard wheels on the concrete. Like, I couldn't enjoy anything if it wasn't, like, fentanyl was the first concern.
Brian could consider himself lucky. During the period that he was on the streets, from November 2020 to April 2023, 1,683 people died in San Francisco due to a drugs overdose. Most of them from synthetic opioids like fentanyl.
Our correspondent James Clayton in San Francisco. And if you'd like to hear more about how fentanyl is destroying lives in the US and in other countries like Mexico, search BBC The Documentary Fentanyl online, or wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Still to come in this edition of Global News, as Gambia moves one step closer to reversing a female genital mutilation ban, we get reaction from a victim who was in Parliament.
Survivors were breaking down just hearing how these men were standing there and telling us that FGM does not affect us.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being. I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaur.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're hearing from some incredible women about what their countries are getting right.
And picking the best bits for our female fantasy land. Because you can't build it if you can't imagine it first. Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Lise Doucette with the Global Story Podcast. Today, we have rare access to Sudan, a country, entire communities, millions of lives torn apart by a devastating war. A war which many Sudanese believe the world has forgotten or is just ignoring. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from our BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, has been shaken by one of the most violent days in the country's spiralling security crisis. People in one of the city's wealthier districts are said to be in panic mode after armed gangs rampaged through the streets. Mac Archer is an anthropologist in Haiti and told us what life is like in Port-au-Prince at the moment.
What is happening here in the metropolitan area is not the same as what is happening outside in other departments. As far as Port-au-Prince, the past 24 hours has been pretty tense. We are seeing more violence in areas that we have not seen before as different gangs are trying to push into new territory, specifically in the Pétionville area. But outside of the metropolitan area of Port-au-Prince, the remaining departments are pretty untouched. They do not have or face the same type of insecurity in the means of gangs. They do not have the same type of group of people that are enacting a type of political unrest and violence.
Hopes for political stability in Haiti have hung on the establishment of a transitional council. The US State Department now says the council will soon be confirmed, though the position of the country's powerful gangs could be pivotal in its success. From Haiti, our correspondent Will Grant.
From the moment Haiti's unelected but Washington-backed Prime Minister Ariel Henry stood down this month, The US State Department has been vocal in its support for a 7-member transitional council. Yet even though one might nominally take charge, it is hard to see how it can govern or bring greater stability to Haiti, even in the short term. For many Haitians, it feels like the political steps being taken by outside nations pale into insignificance against the scale of the security crisis and the humanitarian emergency inside Haiti. On the security side, the capital Port-au-Prince was again plunged into violence when gunmen carried out a massacre in the wealthy neighbourhood of Piétonville. A judge's home was also attacked in the district, creating a deep sense of panic among many residents. The humanitarian crisis also continues to worsen, with the executive director of UNICEF, Catherine Russell, describing the situation in Haiti as horrific and warning that many people in the country are suffering from serious hunger and malnutrition. Desperately needed aid is still not getting in fast enough.
Now, as you may have heard in the last edition of Global News, a bill seeking to decriminalise female genital mutilation, or FGM, in the Gambia has passed its latest parliamentary stage. Though FGM was outlawed in 2015, some seeking to overturn the ban argue it violates religious freedom and is against the country's cultural practices. The bill will now go to committees of lawmakers in Parliament for further consideration. Survivors of FGM and other activists had hoped it would be thrown out, including one of the survivors who was present in the Gambian Parliament on Monday, Fatou Balde. She's a Gambian women's rights activist and campaigns to end female genital mutilation. She gave my colleague Victoria Uwanhunda her reaction.
It was mixed emotions. It wasn't just about FGM. It was sitting in the parliament and hearing men talk about what should happen to little girls' bodies, and also men trivializing the pain of FGM. So it wasn't just about the decision they took. It's how they just stood there. Men who will never understand what it is like to live with the consequences of FGM were the ones who were making decisions as to what the future of Gambian girls will look like.
So what arguments then were being used by those who support the bill?
Mostly the two main arguments were that this is a religious obligation and that it is a culture and traditional norm that we've been practicing for centuries, and we shouldn't change that, and girls should continue to be caught.
So now it's going on to further to a committee in Parliament with lawmakers to decide upon it. Do you expect it to eventually succeed? Do you see the president giving it assent?
There is a high chance that it would succeed. Women's rights advocate, anti-FGM, we've been fighting tirelessly to make sure that the bill doesn't reach to this stage. Unfortunately, it has, and it has been moved on to the committee stage. So that just telling you how powerful these men are and how influential they are. So we are still hanging there. We will continue our advocacy, and we do hope that even if it passes through the committee stage, that the president will reject the bill, because the Gambia is not an island. We have signed treaties both at the international, at the regional level, CEDAW, CRC, the Mobutu Protocol, which are all treaties that hold us obliged to have these laws and legislations to support women and girls.
So it was a heated debate in Parliament yesterday during the session. I wonder what's been the reaction from the Gambian public.
It's been a mixed reaction. And for me, sitting in the parliament, there were survivors in there, and it was re-traumatizing. And survivors were breaking down just hearing how these men were standing there and telling us that FGM does not affect us. So it was really sad just being there. And the whole parliament outside, there were people everywhere, both people who support the continuation of the practice, but also those who are advocating against it.
Fatou Balde with Victoria Uwanhunda. To football now. In Italy, the Inter Milan defender Francesco Acerbi has left the Italian squad ahead of their games with Venezuela and Ecuador. He was alleged to have racially abused Napoli's Brazilian international Juan Jesus in Sunday's Serie A match, something Acerbi has denied. Vincenzo Crendendino from Naples explains what happened in the match.
Here we have, like, let's call it a mystery, because on Sunday evening, Juan Jesus stopped playing. He went to referee La Penna explaining Francesco Acerbi had used the N-word in front of him. He was quiet, he was calm. La Penna actually heard it, but couldn't stop the game. because was not present there when Acerbi used the word. So the game went on. At the end of the match, Juan Jesus said that this is stuff that can happen in the field. So the same Juan Jesus, who was the object of the word, defended the other player, Francesco Acerbi, trying to save him from a long absence from the field. But what happened? Yesterday, Francesco Acerbi was interviewed by some journalists in the street and said, after many hours from the match, I repeat, from after many hours from the match, that he didn't say anything, that maybe Juan Jesus had misunderstood, and that he had not even said, I'm sorry, because after the match, Juan Jesus said, there's no problem, he said sorry, then this is stuff that can happen, let's go on.
How is it that he has decided to leave the squad?
Actually, he did not decide to leave the squad. It was something organized with the Italian team. The Italian team is not sure if Acerbi said or not this, but meanwhile, he prefers to keep Acerbi out of the team to avoid other problems, you know, to keep the team quiet. But yesterday, late night, Juan Jesus wrote everything on Instagram profile. He said, I tried to keep the thing in the field, but I have to protect myself and I have to protect my values. So here what happened. Francesco Acerbi told me, you are just, and used again the N-word. So now we are just waiting for the work of the Italian sport justice. The judge today will just ask for another investigation.
Vincenzo Crendendino with Isaac Fannin, and Francesco Acerbi has denied making any of the statements that he's been accused of. There was no shortage of jaw-droppingly memorable moments in Prince Andrew's 2019 interview with the BBC programme Newsnight, which focused on his relationship with the late convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Now it's been turned into a Netflix film with Billy Piper as the producer Sam McAllister, who landed the interview, and Gillian Anderson playing Emily Maitlis, the former Newsnight host who did it. They've both been talking to our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Thursday, 2 p.m, the Palace.
It's Newsnight, the movie.
Two chairs in the middle of the floor, 6 feet apart.
Well, more specifically, a Netflix dramatisation of how producer Sam McAllister secured Emily Maitlis's 2019 interview with Prince Andrew. Here's how that programme began.
For nearly a decade, a member of the royal family has been dogged by questions about his friendship with a convicted paedophile.
In Scoop, Sam McAllister is played by Billy Piper.
She's so high energy and unlike anyone I've ever met, actually. And, you know, what she's done is so important.
With Gillian Anderson portraying Emily Maitlis.
I've never been smuggled into a palace before.
To go back to 2019, when the interview was first broadcast.
I have a peculiar medical condition, which is that I don't sweat.
What are your memories of that?
Just a gawk. Like, couldn't believe what I was seeing and sort of felt like, I don't know if I'll ever see anything like this again.
It feels like it's a car crash in slow motion in a way, and it just throws up so many questions.
Why do you need to make a dramatic version of it when the original is still there for everyone to see?
Well, because this, as much as anything, is about the story behind, you know, it's about the people behind the acquisition of the interview.
Everything's changed. The FBI are raiding Epstein's home. You can't stay silent.
People don't realise what goes into these interviews. You know, the preparation, but also what goes wrong, what can go wrong, the different moments where it almost didn't happen. So why not dramatise up until one of the most important and dramatic interviews in history?
Tomorrow night, in an unprecedented interview, we will hear from the Duke himself.
At first, Gillian Anderson actually turned down the role.
I originally said no. As
did
I often
you?
Say, yeah, I did. I mean, it's just too scary to play Emily Maitlis.
No. Why?
Well, because she's still living, because she's so formidable, because people know her so well. And I thought, I probably do have to do it because I'm so scared of it.
This isn't the only version of the story being made. Emily Maitlis herself is executive producer on a rival three-part Amazon series. This made it slightly awkward when Gillian Anderson bumped into her after filming had begun.
I knew her so well by that point. I was like going in for like a really, you know, friendly hug.
Where did you meet her?
Oh, it was at a charity event. I mean, the hilarious part of it was that I had come to this event not having prepared at all and was really disheveled. And she showed up as Emily Maitlis, who looks like a movie star. Short white skirt and tanned legs and everything. And I literally looked like her great aunt.
As for Prince Andrew, he's played by Rufus Sewell.
If I do an interview, the question is, why you?
With 3 hours of makeup each day transforming him into a startlingly accurate lookalike.
When I heard it was Rufus, I was like, really? How would that face carved from gold?
Yeah.
Is this going to make sense? And it was unreal seeing him that first time.
And particularly once you get into the interview.
Oh, my God, yeah.
It's uncanny.
You know, I thought that all went very well.
Prince Andrew famously thought that the interview had been a triumph. Gillian Anderson and Billy Piper both agree there is almost no chance he will watch this version.
That report from our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson. Finally, there's no place like home. Where would The Wizard of Oz be without Dorothy's pair of magic ruby red slippers? One of the last surviving pairs, worn by Judy Garland in the classic film, is going on a world tour before being auctioned off later this year. Here's Ella Bicknell.
You have to see the wizard, the wonderful wizard of Oz.
Off to see the wizard, these slippers are off to see the world. As one of the most recognisable pieces of movie memorabilia, these sparkling shoes will be displayed in New York, London, then Tokyo, before they're auctioned off in December. But just like Dorothy, they've had quite the adventure already.
They're gone! The ruby slippers! What have you done with them? Give them back to me or I'll...
It's too late. There they are and there they'll stay.
One of four remaining pairs, they first hit the headlines in 2005 when they were stolen from a museum in Judy Garland's hometown in the US state of Minnesota. 13 years later, they were recovered in an FBI sting operation. Now their owner, the former actor-turned-collector Michael Shaw, has put them up for sale with an estimated value of around $3.5 million.
And think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
The ruby slippers were at the heart of the famous 1939 Technicolor musical. In them, Dorothy dances around the yellow brick road, meets her companions Scarecrow, Tin Man and Lion, and by clicking her heels 3 times and saying, "There's no place like home," they magically transport her back to Kansas. They've become a symbol of the glittering glamour of Hollywood.
Ella Bicknell reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, drop us an email. It's globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Or you'll find us on X, where we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes Porter. The producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
This week on Witness History, we're bringing you fascinating stories from China. And what could be more fascinating than the discovery of China's mysterious terracotta army? 50 years on, we hear from the amazing archaeologists who first dug them up, plus the story of a forgotten hero whose invention helped millions of Chinese citizens learn to read and write. And Wham! How one of Britain's biggest pop groups became the first Western act to play in China. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.